This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, I'm Kate Forrester, and thanks for joining me this Thursday afternoon for the Country Hour. It's great to be with you from now up until the 1 o'clock news. And on today's program, I'm going to take a little bit of a zip around the grain growing regions in WA just to get a bit of an understanding on how receivables have been this past week at CBH's zones. I guess just to see how much this wet weather has impacted on receivables and cycle times and what's expected in the next week or so. And then just after the news at 12:30, I will be chatting to the Bureau of Meteorology to hear when we can expect that warmer weather to really set in, and fingers crossed, just in time for summer, hopefully, which is next Monday, can you believe? It is crazy to think that. Anyway, it is 12:06 here on the Country Hour right across the state, and there has been a mixed reaction from primary industries to the big news today that Labor has struck a deal with the Greens to reform environment laws in exchange for more federal oversight of forestry and land clearing and no fast-tracking for coal and gas projects. There will be a new National Environmental Protection Agency, higher fines for environmental breaches, tighter controls on land clearing, and $300 million for a forestry growth fund. Here's the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, announcing the changes this morning.
More than 5 years after Professor Graham Samuel handed down his independent review into the nation's 25-year-old environmental laws that were widely acknowledged as not being fit for purpose, the government's Environment Protection Reform Bill will be passed by the Senate today. The bill will amend the EPBC Act, providing a balanced set of reforms that not only protect the environment for this and future generations, but importantly as well, deliver more certainty for business and the community by helping to speed up decision-making for projects in key areas of national priority, like housing, renewable energy and critical minerals. These laws will reduce approval times from years to months and from months to weeks. For the first time, Australia will have a National Environment Protection Agency, a strong independent regulator with a clear focus on ensuring better compliance with and stronger enforcement of Australia's new environmental laws. In another first, Australia will have national environmental standards to ensure clear, strong guidelines to protect the environment. There will be higher penalties for the most significant breaches of environmental law, as well as environment protection orders for use in urgent circumstances to prevent and respond to major contraventions of the law. We are removing and sunsetting the exemption from the EPBC Act for high-risk land clearing and regional forest agreements, so they comply with the same rules and standards as other industries. To complement this, today we're announcing that my government will establish a $300 million forestry growth fund to deliver a bigger forestry industry that supports more secure jobs, better pay and high value output. The timber fibre strategy developed with industry outlines how the forestry sector is increasingly relying on plantation timber, which provides opportunities to improve the sustainability of the industry and move up the value chain for timber products. This is about using science and evidence to prove all forestry in Australia is undertaken at the highest standard. The government is backing forestry and timber workers through our Forestry Growth Fund that will invest in new equipment and facilities to enable industry modernisation and advanced processing. Things like retooling of timber mills that is so important for the industry going forward.
There you go. That was Prime Minister Anthony Albanese addressing the media earlier today. And the bill is expected to pass through the Senate later on today. Opposition leader Susan Lee says Labor's agreement with the Greens to overhaul Australia's environmental laws is a dirty deal. 12:09. And the National Farmers Federation is worried the devil could be in the detail in this deal between Labor and the Greens. Warwick Ragg is the NFF's head of natural resource management, and he thinks this new legislation will put a big question mark over what farmers can or can't do on their own land.
We're feeling disappointed and still a little unclear about what these reforms really mean for agriculture. So what we've seen today is an announcement by the Prime Minister that they're going to put closer controls on high-risk land clearing. That terminology, high-risk land clearing, is a new term. We're trying to understand what that means. And we understand, though we've not seen this in writing yet, that that effectively means there's a limit on regrowth age of 15 years. So if your regrowth is older than 15 years, it probably means that you're not going to be able to touch it. Now, having said that, land clearing is a province of the states, and we don't know how this is going to interact with various state legislations, and we're not sure which parts of the EPBC Act are going to be required to be aligned to whatever state regimes are in place. During next year, we will see a need to develop matters of national environmental significance standards, which will have bilaterals following, and those things will be critical to understand how this is going to impact. So whatever law they pass today will have to come with some subsequent explanation about how it's going to work, how we're going to operate, how we're going to undertake standardised agricultural practice.
So this is the start of you trying to understand what this means for you, even though it's a deal done to get through Parliament.
Yeah, so it'll be a high-level deal, a line in legislation probably, and the devil will be, as it always is, in the detail and in the implementation. As I understand the way this country works at the moment, the Commonwealth doesn't have power to control land clearing directly, but it does have the power to protect threatened species, which may or may not occur on agricultural land, and that will be a complex issue to understand. The reason we're here is that we want to take this dual consent issue away, where you have to get permission from the Commonwealth to do one thing and permission from the state to do another thing on the same piece of land. And often you find that you've complied with the state law and then find out there's a federal law that you weren't fully aware of. We need to get a better understanding of how that's going to work and stop that dual consent and give farmers greater certainty and greater clarity. I'm not sure we've got that today, but we'll continue working on making sure we get the best outcome we can for farmers.
Stewards of over half of Australia's farmland. Is it disappointing in the sense that you didn't have a greater say then or a greater seat at the table in working out how these laws were going to affect you?
Look, we've been involved in these consultations. It is disappointing. I think I'd characterise it as being bitterly disappointed that the detail of this, which seems to be agreed late last night, really hasn't been fully explained to us. We were aware this was a concern, but how it was going to be implemented is not something anyone's been able to help us understand yet.
So what are the next step? What are the key details that you're looking for first?
I want to see how high-risk land clearing is defined. I want to see how it's then transferred to align with state legislation and how the states are going to respond to that. So we'll assumedly get this done today or early tomorrow. Then we'll be back early in the year. We've already got copies of the Matters of National Environmental Significance standards to comment on by the end of January. So the discussion will go on, but the fundamental law that seems to limit the capacity to undertake regrowth management looks like it's going to be gone through today with the help of the Greens, who frankly have been running this campaign for over a decade, and it's based on a false premise. There is no land clearing loophole in the federal laws because they belong to the states.
But high-risk land clearing is the phrase that you really need clarity on and that you think farmers will need clarity on after today.
100%. And it might be better. It might be a narrowing of general land clearing or regrowth management. And regrowth management isn't land clearing. So let's understand what the guardrails they're trying to put around this are and then work on a pathway for implementation.
So this is a deal done between Labor and the Greens to pass this legislation. The government was working hard to negotiate with the Coalition and the Greens to try and find a partner to get its legislation through. Would have it been any different if this legislation was getting through with the help of the Coalition instead? Of the Greens?
Our understanding as at 8 o'clock last night was that if the deal was done with Coalition, it would not have included this provision on high risk land clearing.
So ultimately, in your mind, then this is a worse deal for farmers than what it could have been?
Yes.
I suppose, what's the timeline from here then for you as a farming organisation and for this legislation, how it could impact farmers who are listening to this today?
Well, we'll have to continue to work and work with our members to understand this and then figure out a pathway of response and sensible implementation, if that's possible.
Warwick Ragg is General Manager of Natural Resource Management for the National Farmers Federation, and he was speaking to Warwick Long. And on the text line, Brian from Tamblup has shared his thoughts. He says, what shock, our Prime Minister taking the science on board now? Where was it with live sheep trade? Talk about flip-flopping for votes. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. You can do the same on 0448 922 604. If you've got something to say on these new environmental laws, just text in 0448 922 604. It is 12:15, and there's been a mixed reaction from the resources sector to these new environment laws. Warren Pearce is the CEO of the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies. He thinks the reforms are a big step forward and says they will reduce duplication, they'll speed up approvals, and they'll also provide investment certainty within the resources sector.
Look, we have been waiting a long time, and this is certainly landmark legislation. I think some in our industry will be sceptical of a Labor Greens deal, but if you look at the whole package of reforms, it's actually pretty good, and it does actually deliver on better environmental outcomes and better outcomes for business, and that, I think, was the real test of good legislation. So it means for new projects that would be pulled into the federal environmental process, you potentially save 12 or 18 months in the approvals process to get to a decision. So what happens now is a process goes into the state environmental approval system. That might take 3 or 4 years. And then after it goes through that process, then it starts in the federal environmental approval system, which takes another 12 or 18 months. In the new arrangements with bilaterals for Western Australia, what would take place is the state government would assess against both the state and federal legislation and then make recommendations to both the state and federal minister. That could shortcut the process by 12 or 18 months. And obviously that's a big time and cost saving for industry. So there's still a lot of work to go here to actually implement these changes. You have to remember, the Commonwealth environmental legislation is incredibly complex. It's a very, very big change we're undertaking, but a very important one too. So we've got to get it right.
AMEC CEO Warren Pearce, and he thinks it's going to take about 6 months before national environmental standards are drawn up, and then up to a year before bilateral arrangements are agreed upon between state and federal governments before the legislation is fully implemented. Tanya Constable is the CEO of the Minerals Council of Australia, and she doesn't think the reforms strike the right balance, labelling the bill as inferior.
Well, I'm disappointed that the government have chosen to do a deal with the Greens. This particular bill does not strike the right balance between what is protecting the environment and good outcomes to get real projects on the ground, particularly in Western Australia. The resources industry is so important to the whole economy, and this bill, had the amendments that we put forward been adopted, would have made a huge difference and in fact provided a net improvement to the resources sector. And at the moment, I think there are some aspects that we're deeply concerned about. We've seen a few amendments go through that were important to the industry, but not enough to strike that balance in protecting the environment and promoting a stronger mining sector and resources sector overall.
You mentioned some of the wins, and I think there's about three elements that have been adopted that the MCA did put forward in a submission that have been adopted. Where do you think it's fallen short?
Well, it's fallen short in a couple of areas. First, there is a national EPA that doesn't have enough guardrails around it. It doesn't promote that streamlining that we would have liked to see. When you've got a national EPA that is doing assessments, delegated approvals, compliance and assurance function, that's a very large function. But importantly, you don't need some of those things if you're going to move to accreditation. And that's what this is all about. To get the benefits for a strong industry, one set of environmental laws is enough, and streamlining the assessment approval process to make sure that Western Australia could do the assessment approvals would have meant faster project assessment and approval times and real projects on the ground, which means that Western Australians would be wealthier at the end of the day, and we wouldn't be arguing about other issues like GSTs along the way.
This legislation has been a long time coming. Do you believe that it's a lost opportunity?
It's a huge lost opportunity. Look, I won't say that the government haven't tried to make some amendments to the legislation to try and meet the needs of industry, but this does not strike the right balance in terms of getting real projects on the ground, and it sends the wrong investment signal to investors that might be investing in particular gas projects in Western Australia. So that's a concern. It should be a concern for West Australians to see that that balance is not there at the moment. But as I said, we are now going to try and make sure that we work with the government, we work with other political parties, we work with stakeholders to get the standards sorted as quickly as possible that will be needed for this enabling legislation. And those standards will help us get to a position where the states can be accredited. Once those standards are in place, as fast as we possibly can get them, then we'll see real benefits for the industry. But at the moment, we'll be just relying on the government to make that happen. So the pressure needs to stay on the government to ensure that we get the fastest possible outcomes to those standards. And they need to be done properly. They need to be consulted on widely, and they need to make sure that we get real projects on the ground as fast as possible.
That's the CEO of the Minerals Council of Australia, Tanya Constable, speaking to Tara de Landgraft.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, after quite a big spell of wet weather, the good news for grain growers is that it looks like things are now starting to dry up. And shortly I'm going to check in with the Bureau of Meteorology after the news headlines at 12:30 to find out when those temperatures are expected to rise. But let's head down to the south of the state now, to the Esperance region, where CBH zone manager Paul Channon says they've hit the halfway mark for their harvest season.
I guess with the rain around last week, we've taken full advantage of that, moving grain pretty heavily at the port to free up grid capacity, but also out through both the areas, making the most of the quiet time that we've got. So as far as the receivables go, canola's sort of starting to, over halfway and into the sort of final stages of that receival, and barley starting to taper off as well. So although, some sites still reasonably heavy with barley, but you can definitely see the wheat now really starting to kick into gear.
And given that there has been a few rain events now, the quality of that wheat coming in, I mean, is it still sound, or could there be some falling number concerns?
Quality's been reasonably good. We have seen early signs of some sprouting, so we'll definitely just be keeping our eye on that as we get into the next week of receivals. But we're geared up to manage that well in the zone.
CBH Esperance Zone General Manager Paul Channon, and so far they have taken in 2.16 million tonnes of grain. Will Piercy manages the Albany Port Zone for CBH, and he says even with all the recent rain, they have still seen a new daily receival record at one of their sites, and it's mainly barley and canola coming in at the moment.
We had seen some wheat started to be delivered in the northern part of the zone, but definitely barley and canola at this stage. Yeah, so we've received about 1.2 million tonnes to date so far, which is a little bit behind where we were last year. So hopefully we get some good weather and we can get some tonnes in the bin.
And despite the rain and intense weather, when programs were able to get back on track, I hear we had some good news with a new daily receival record at one of your sites. What happened?
Yeah, so we had a really good day at Gardner River. They had 14,000 tonnes in a day, and over that was 10,000 tonnes of canola, so a huge effort from the team.
Good to hear. Will Piercy is the Albany Port Zone Manager, and he was just speaking to Amelia Searson. And CBH Kwinana South Zone Manager Irving Carey says their cycle times have been pretty good in the last week.
We received 415,000 tonne in the lorries. So, yeah, definitely a bit of slowing down due to the weather. So I think today we'll probably just click over 1.4 million today sometime, and that's in totality for harvest so far.
What has been delivered, and has the hail affected the quality coming in this week?
Yeah, I think there are reports of some growers being impacted by hail, and definitely some flooding that we've seen up in the Kulin for us. So, yeah, definitely still a lot of canola coming in. That's still the number one. A bit of barley and a bit of wheat. More and more growers seem to be jumping onto their wheat. Still heavily dominated by canola at the moment.
Has the wet weather affected delivery times at all?
No, the cycle times are actually improved because of the slowness of harvest. There's actually been less harvest, less growers actually harvesting this week. Which means there's less trucks coming to sites, which means there's actually a better cycle time. So there's a slight reduction in the cycle time. I think we're sitting at about 34 minutes at the moment, which is pretty good.
And what's on the horizon for the next 7 days?
Yeah, so it's ramping up. That's what's on the horizon. So yesterday we did over 100,000 tonne in Kwinana South. With the dry weather again, we'll click over 100K. So I'd say for the next 7 days, it's looking pretty good for harvesting conditions. And we'd like to see the back of the canola at the end of next week sometime start to focus more on wheat, just depending on how much of this canola we got to go.
Kwinana South Zone General Manager Irving Carey speaking to Rachel Boothman. And if I move further north now to Geraldton, where Zone Manager Colette Newton says, with certain grades dominating deliveries, she's asking for growers' patience as they get back into harvest after the rain.
We've just ticked over 1.8 million tonne received, so it's started to pick up, especially the wheat tonnes.
And I understand the wheat's coming in, but canola's still coming in hard and fast as well. You're finding somewhere to put it all?
Yeah, canola definitely. Certainly in Area 1, Nangaloo, one of our park precinct sites, hit its daily record again for the second time this year on Monday. Out of the 17,000 tonne it received, 15,000 of that was canola.
Wow, so there's some pretty big figures coming in. How are you managing everything? Are you sort of starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, look, I think, to be honest, listening to the local growers and the yields that they're seeing come off the paddocks, I think we're expected to see a much bigger crop than anticipated. But in terms of, you know, preparedness, we're good. We're in a good position in terms of storage. It's more just the balance now of grids and the capacity and the throughput and just managing that to the best of our abilities. So I would ask the growers just to be patient, talk to the area managers, talk to the site managers, and I'm sure they'll give updates and let growers know what's going on. And the other one to shout out was a big shout out to the Minginew team, who also beat their daily receival record this week on Tuesday, hitting nearly 20,000 tonne in a day.
Oh, it's good to hear from Minginew. That was Colette Newton, who is the Geraldton Port Zone Manager, and she was speaking to Tara DeLandgraft. 12:29, and on the text line, quite a few of you still wanting to have your say on those new environmental laws that Anthony Albanese spoke about earlier today, and just that deal that they've struck with the Greens to reform them. On the text line, Helen says, does this land clearing environmental standards also apply to urban areas where this is wholesale clearing for housing, or is it once again just applying to rural areas? Thank you for your text, Helen. You can have your say. Just text in on 0448 922 604. Jonathan Beale is in the studio for the headlines.
Thanks, Kate. The Premier says the Federal Liberal Party has let West Australians down by not engaging more constructively in the overhaul of the country's environment laws. The opposition leader, Susan Lee, says the coalition negotiated with the government late into last night before being sidelined from the discussions. Labor instead struck a deal with the Greens, which will see the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act pass Parliament today. Roger Cook says the Liberals are an embarrassment. Australia is projected to fall short of a key climate commitment target. Figures from the Climate Change Authority have been released by the Energy Minister and show Australia is on track to reach a 42% reduction in emissions by the end of the decade, 1% short of its legislated target. And Federal MP Barnaby Joyce has announced he's quitting the National Party. The former Deputy Prime Minister left the National's party room and confirmed he would not recontest the seat of New England at the next election as a National. He used a speech in the lower house to declare his intentions. There's been speculation Mr. Joyce would defect to One Nation, but he did not mention the party in his speech. More news, Kate, at 1 o'clock.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, it is 29 away from 1 o'clock on the Country Hour, and coming up between now and then, we're going to head to the Mount Barker cattle sale from earlier today and just get those numbers and a bit of an update on what happened there. But now I'm going to head to the Bureau of Meteorology, where Joey Rawson is with me. Joey, we've been just hearing about the grain receivables and how they've been a little bit down the past week across the regions of WA. Is it warming up once and for all for growers in the south of the state?
Yeah, there is certainly some good news. We've got a west coast trough starting to develop over the next couple of days with a nice high pressure ridge pushing into the south, which means it's not really slowly warming up. It's heating up quite quickly when these things form. So by the time we get to the end of the weekend, we've got quite hot temperatures. And for the Southwest Land Division, by the time we get to Saturday, we're not expecting really any rain, maybe just a little bit of cloud between Albany and Esperance, but, yeah, less than 0.2 of a millimetre, so nothing significant there. And, yeah, once we're into Sunday, Monday, it's all clear. All stations go for getting those harvests done, Kate.
Oh, it sounds like good news to me. And what about if we now move further north? What's happening there?
Yeah, it's a little bit interesting through the north, especially through that kind of Wyndham, El Questro area. We've still got some lingering issues with ex-tropical cyclone Athena, so there's some thunderstorms that are hanging around, and they're going to hang around for a few more days. But as we progress into the end of the week and into the weekend, the storms that are currently in the Kimberley are going to start moving into the Pilbara and then start pushing into the Gascoyne by the time we get to Saturday. And then once we're into kind of Sunday and Monday, those storms are going to continue to extend down from the north and potentially getting all the way to the central west. So a lot of storm activity expected through the north. And yes, by the time we're on Monday, we could have some storms and some potential lightning pushing into even the northern parts of the Southwest Land Division.
Thanks, Joey. Joey Rawson just giving us a little bit of an update on what's going on the weather front for this afternoon and the next couple of days. Richard Hudson now in the studio for the rainfall.
Yeah, which is only really in the Kimberley. Bedford Downs had 20 mils, Diggers Rest 11, Ellenbrae topped it with 98, Kachana 21, Kalumburu 14, Kununurra had between 17 and 34 across a few locations, Lansdowne and Theta 5 mils, Parry Creek Farm 15, Yulmbu 7, and nowhere else in Western Australia recorded any more than 2 mils.
Mm. Now, just before you scoot off, Richard, today is Oz Music T-shirt Day, and if you were to wear a T-shirt that was all about, oh, hang on, have you got one on?
In the Pines? That's a music concert at UWA. Yep.
Oh, very good. You're hiding it under your jacket. Well, happy Oz Music T-shirt day today, Richard.
Happy Oz Music T-shirt day to you too.
Thank you very much. Richard Hudson there with the rainfall. It is 26 away from 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. And a South Coast rural mum is keen to raise awareness about dealing with postpartum rage, particularly for those in more remote parts of Australia. Ali Gossage is from Munglinup in the Ravensthorpe Shire and says she felt so isolated and alienated after giving birth to her second baby.
The first time round was quite different to the second. He was a really, really great baby. He slept anywhere. He'd fall asleep on the kitchen floor if I left him there. I don't think I experienced much in the way of mental health with postpartum and things like that. It was more when my second came around that the curveballs came.
What happened?
I developed postpartum rage. And, yeah, it was just something that I'd never experienced before or never heard before. I would black out rage, scream, throw things, and it would literally just be over the most minute, tiny thing. My son would ask me for a drink and I would just absolutely go off the rocker. And, yeah, I just had no idea what was happening when I didn't experience it with my first. So it was just such an unknown sort of thing, and it took me a while to tell my husband because I was like, oh, I don't want him to to think like what's going on, like you're not safe to be with the kids and things like that. And I definitely felt that. So yeah, it wasn't until I reached out to the Motherland community, which is where I did an online 6-week rural mothers group program through them, and one of the mums, Kate Brow, she contacted me and just said, hey, look, I've experienced something similar. This is what it is. And then, yeah, I just went on a deep dive of researching and I was like, holy crap, this is it.
Had you heard about it before? Because I feel like there's a little bit more discussion about postnatal depression, but rage, I feel like that is not something that people are really talking about as much.
No, it definitely was. And I was really hesitant to speak out about it because I didn't know what I was going to be met with on the other side. Yeah, like how do you talk to someone that you just don't know what you're going to do in that moment? Like you're just not the person you are when you snap. So, yeah, it was really, really terrifying. But thankfully, yeah, when I had a bit of an answer as to what it was, I was referred on to the Gidget Foundation and went through counselling and stuff through that, and still see them today. And yeah, it was honestly the best thing I ever did.
Obviously, you would be able to attest with your two very different experiences postpartum that not every postpartum experience is going to look the same. Some people don't go through postpartum depression and rage, other people do. That coupled with the fact that there's this stigma that's lurking around mums asking for help and not wanting to be perceived as incapable of looking after their children. Did you find it hard to talk to people about this and open up about your experience because you were fearful of, I suppose, the potential backlash that could come your way if you were to tell people how you really felt?
Yeah. Everyone just, yeah, talks about like, oh, how great motherhood is and this is all I've ever wanted to do and I love my babies and everything is hunky-dory. But when you actually start to open up and actually get into the nitty-gritty and ask those questions like, are you okay? How are you going? And asking those deeper questions, that's where you start to delve in and get some more answers. Like I have three older sisters and two of them have kids. And when I was going through it, I just asked them, I was like, was it hard for you? Did you experience anything like just the isolation, the identity shift of becoming a mother? And they're like, oh, yeah, like we did, but we just had to get on with it. Like no one just spoke about it, so we just got on with it. And I was like, well, no, like I feel so alienated right now. It would have been really, really helpful if you had just opened up a bit more and been like, yeah, I actually did experience this. Yeah, so it would have been advantageous if people do speak up, but I 1,000% get why we don't, because it's terrifying to be seen as failing and not coping and everything like that.
And you're in a rural area. You're, you know, about an hour away from Esperance, which is, you know, then an 8 hours drive to Perth. What was it like getting help when you live in such a rural place?
I first tried the route of doing telehealth. Like I did a telehealth doctor's consult to get a mental health care plan, but I was turned away there because they don't offer that service. Yeah, so it was really, really hard to try to get that help. Eventually I was able to see an in-person GP and sort of get the ball rolling, but I have done all of my psychologist appointments and everything via telehealth because, unfortunately, it's just the only option, and it did work for us. Like, my psychologist was over in Sydney, so we had that time difference, but I was able to have a session at 6:30 in the morning, so my husband was able to be home with the kids and do breakfast, do all of that with them, and then I was able to have my hour session, and then we would tag in and tag out and he would go to work and I'd start the day.
You mentioned before that you found it difficult to open up about how you were feeling to your husband because you didn't know how he was going to react. At what point did you talk to him and how did that conversation go?
Not much talking happened, a lot of crying. it was just, I didn't want him to think that I wasn't doing a good job, which he never ever thought. And when I did open up and talk to him about what I was feeling and what I was experiencing, he just held space for me and was like, well, okay, well, like, what's our next step? What can we do? Which thankfully he was, yeah, really, really helpful and helping me and letting me get that help, which is really been great for us.
Good on you, Ali. It's not an easy thing to do to ask for help. So good on you for taking that step and getting better and then now becoming a spokesperson for other women who are listening or other mums, other parents who might be going through the same thing. It's so important to know that you're not alone and these feelings are not weird or shouldn't be talked about, you know. So good on you.
It definitely needs to happen more.
100%. And if there are any new mums listening, expecting mums, maybe their partners, their family, what would you say to them? What do you wish you knew when you were going through this?
That although you do feel alone, that you're not. And I know that it's scary and vulnerable and you do feel like a failure when you ask for help and things like that, but it is so common and you just need to because it does really take a village. I hated that saying when I first heard it and I completely and utterly understand what it means that it does take a village to raise a child and you need a village.
What sort of changes would you like to see made in order to improve the situation for mums in this space?
I feel like easier access to like more resources and things like that. Like when we leave hospital, I know we don't read all the little nitty gritty things of all the pamphlets that we're given, but just targeted resources like for rural mums with the Gidget Foundation or Motherland or all those ones that are out there to help rural mums in the thick of it, just be able to have those resources on handy. And then if we're not coping, just having it in the back of our mind to go, oh, yeah, actually, I do remember seeing something like that, and then being able to refer onto it. Like, I wouldn't have found half of these places if my husband hadn't sat me down and made me watch an episode of Landline. That was how I found Motherland and then got referred onto the Gidget Foundation. So without that, yeah, I don't know where I would have been.
Mungling Up Mum, Ali Gossage, sharing her story with Amelia Searson. And it is Perinatal Mental Health Week this week, which is all about supporting the well-being of mums and their families at each stage of motherhood. And Ali was at Parliament House in Canberra this week trying to share her story and also trying to make a difference for rural women.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
We're 3 hours from Catherine, doing School of the Air.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
The ABC sent me over to Tasmania.
And up in the north, in Launceston, I think it was, there was a meeting of the CWA, and I was talking to them. But I noticed that sitting down in the front seat, there was an obviously English lady. I don't know why she was so obviously English. But she had with her an enormous dog, and he turned out to be a big Afghan hound. So she said, "I comb that hair out, then I spin it, and I make a sort of wool out of it. Look at this." And she held up a jacket. And she was making all sorts of interesting things out of the hair of the dog. No suggestion the hair of the dog that bit her.
That's the voice of Lorna Byrne. For 14 years, she hosted a weekly segment of the Country Hour called the Country Women's Sessions. The segment started in 1953, and Lorna would travel the country talking to rural women about everything, their interests, working on the land, and even how to help children in war-torn Vietnam. Hello, I'm Annie Brown. This year, the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. Lorna Byrne was a bit of a trailblazer. Not only was she the first woman to be a broadcaster in the ABC's rural department, she was also one of the first women to graduate from Sydney University's agricultural science course. But mostly, she was a fierce advocate for rural Australia.
There are fewer farmers than there used to be, and the fewer there are, the more important they become. And I think they need a great deal more catering for in information, particularly the type of information that the ABC can give them. And I think the farmers at the moment are in need of every possible encouragement. If I had my way, I'd extend the rural department very considerably and give those farming people far more even than they're getting now.
Lorna's time on the Country Women's Sessions came to an end in 1966. Here is some of that final broadcast.
I've always contended that one can be on a job too long, and I knew there'd be a stage at which I should say to myself, it's time to bow out. And I believe that time has come. Oh, no, I'm not physically incapacitated, and I hope I'm still mentally reasonably sound. But those of you who go to parties will probably agree with me that it's a good thing to leave while you're really enjoying the function, not wait until most of the guests are getting worn out. But before I become sentimental and nostalgic, I meant to tell you last week of a girl who's doing some interesting work, and in case your daughter is trying to decide what she should do with her future, you might like to get details of this before next university year begins in your state. The girl with whose parents I stayed in Gunnedah is Miss Rhys Bubb, and she's one of the very few meteorologists in the Weather Bureau so far. Women meteorologists, I mean. She became a qualified meteorologist, and she's stationed with the Bureau in Tasmania. But anyone interested might watch the newspapers and see when cadetships are advertised in the future. I wonder how many of you remember when this session began in 1953. It replaced Blue Hills for one day each week. People didn't like this, and they made no bones at all about telling me so. They wrote scores and scores of letters telling me how bad the session was. How dare I take Blue Hills' time? And anyhow, said one, who wants to hear your harsh, masculine voice? Now, that didn't cheer me up very much, but with a vast amount of help from John Douglas, Dick Snedden, and other members of the staff, later on, of course, Dick Thompson and the present staff, the session got on its feet. You remember that silly zipper story? I advised people some years ago, women who lived alone, not to have frocks with back-fastening zippers. And that brought a hail of letters from all over the place. All sorts of hints and cartoons and so on came with that zipper story. And then there was one that never seems to wear out, although I've told it a good many times, I'm afraid. The time when I just got the session fairly well on its feet. I went to a Western centre in New South Wales for the Red Cross. I went under my married name of Mrs. Hayter. When I confessed that I was the woman who did the session on Fridays, a lady came over to me with some very encouraging words, and she said, "In future, when my kids say to me on a Friday, switch that old hag off, I'll say she's a nice lady." I do want to say thanks to thousands of you for kindness and encouragement, and I'll be with you again next week. Oh, no, of course I won't be with you again next week. And so it's goodbye, everybody.
That's Lorna Byrne, the compere of the Country Women's Sessions, later known as Farm and Life on the Country Hour in 1966. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown.
Wow, what an amazing story. I love listening to that. On ABC Radio WA, this is the WA Country Hour. Well, it is 11 to 1, and as we get closer to summer, you're going to see more and more West Australian grown berries on our supermarket shelves. One of Australia's biggest fresh produce distributors is Mercer Mooney, and Alicia Gold is the company's Perth-based berry specialist. She says they try to get their hands on raspberries and blueberries and blackberries and strawberries from wherever they can in the country. But it's always nice when some lovely fruit is coming in from our own state.
I can sell fruit from all over the country. At the moment, I've primarily got local fruit because we're in the thick of berry season and we've got raspberries coming soon. So, yeah, all local focused at the moment.
The strawberries in front of us here, I was just reading the label and they're from the southwest, aren't they?
Yeah, they're from down near Northcliff. I've got marvellous berries in front of me and they are absolutely, absolutely marvellous. In fact, they're so big that people are almost considering them apples.
And blueberries is sort of coming into the peak of the season, isn't it?
Yeah, we're right in the thick of it now. So we're seeing lots of big fruit, lots of volume coming through the markets. Yeah, blueberries are nice and cheap in the supermarkets for everybody. So I think everybody's just eating a lot of berries at the moment before stone fruit kicks up. Yeah.
And what about the raspberries? When do the local raspberries come in and where are they from in WA?
They're grown all over the place. My raspberries will start next week. Big, beautiful raspberries from the southwest, but there's local raspberries through the markets almost year round.
Are they mostly coming from the more cooler areas?
Yeah, cooler climates. In Australia, our best raspberry growing climate is obviously Tasmania, so anywhere in WA that we can mirror that, as further south as we can go, the better. They're delicate little beauties. They're hollow on the inside, so any kind of adverse weather conditions, they just can't handle it like a blueberry can, and they've got a dense centre to them, so even cold storage is really critical.
How do you manage things? Because you guys are dealing in fruit all year round, and if there's no locally produced fruit, you've got to get it from somewhere. What arrangements do you have to make sure you do constantly have access to berries?
It's honestly pretty tricky. Berries is a unique one because of the shelf life. Apples go into cold stores year round. We can keep apples on the shelf and we can bring them across the country. We can bring them from the US. We can bring them from anywhere and it's fine. Berries really tricky. We try our best to grow berries across Australia in different climates and make sure that we can move them around the country. But in short, there's not enough berries in Australia growing in particular regions at particular times to supply the whole country. So often, particularly in WA, we go without particular lines, particularly raspberries, because we just can't get them here from other states. We can't navigate the laws to get them pest-free and get them here. And we can't keep them, on a truck for a week to get them here. You'll notice on the shelves, in supermarket shelves in WA, there's a lot of the time in the year where we don't have particular lines of berries. But thankfully, strawberries, year-round, we're pretty much covered. You'll see different variations in price, and that kind of controls supply and demand. But strawberries, when over winter we can grow them locally, and then over summer we go down to the southwest and bring fruit up from down there, and we can keep fruit on the shelf year-round. But yeah, there's ebbs and flows in supply and demand across all berries pretty much year-round.
Now, this is a question without notice, so apologies, but I only just thought of it. You know how you see the little TikTok reels and whatnot of women with their little drinks in cafes and everything? Do you think that sort of thing is actually increasing the demand for things like berries?
Well, they think that blueberry consumption has gone up exponentially over the last kind of 5 to 10 years. Strawberries have always been popular. Raspberries are popular, but expensive and hard to get. So I think in Australia, we're just used to that. We're used to raspberries being hard to get, particularly in WA. Like, I grew up in Broome. You'd be lucky to see raspberries on the shelf for a quarter of the year up there. Yeah. So I just didn't grow up eating raspberries. It wasn't my norm. But I think in general, they reckon berry, like, particularly raspberry and blueberry consumption is growing exponentially and probably fueled by those kind of trends. Yeah, particularly blueberries.
So you're from Broome, but how long have you been here at the markets?
I've only been here for just under a year, but my husband's in produce, and I've been with him for 10 years, so I've been around it for a long time. Our fruit basket at home has been well and truly stocked for a long time.
But you've got a bit of a marketing background, haven't you?
Yeah, I came from marketing in AdWorld and took the jump into fruit sales, which has been a bit of a career change, to say the least. But yeah, no, it's good. There's not many young people in here doing this, and there's definitely not many young females doing this, so I'm kind of breaking all the rules a little bit here, but I love it. It's good. Early mornings, the hustle, and home by lunchtime.
I was going to say, was that the draw card for you? You enjoy getting up at 3 a.m. and being here at 4 a.m?
I don't enjoy getting up at 3 a.m, that's for sure, but I'm starting to get used to it. No, but I love the people, and I love making sure that all the independent grocers in WA have good fruit on their shelves, and I love my farmers, the growers that do a fantastic job of getting fruit, amazing fruit to me every day. So, yeah, it's easy to get up every morning when you know that's what you're doing. Yeah, it's good.
Alicia Gold is Mercer Mooney Berries Manager, and she was speaking with Richard Hudson at the Perth Markets at Canning Vale. It is 5 minutes to one, and there was a cattle sale at Mount Barker this morning. 1,613 was the total, so that's down on 129 on last week. Tracy Kilner is at the sale yards. Hi, Tracy. Were the prices good for the farmers today?
Not a bad sale, Kate. Yearling cattle dominated the yarding, remaining mainly firm on last week, selling mostly to feeder buyers. A good quality yarding of new season weaners fluctuated with demand, while the grown steers and heifers sold well to processors. Heavy cows and bulls eased with eastern states bidders absent. Heavyweight weaner steers sold for $4.06 to $4.70, and from $4.24 to $5.30 for the lighter weight steers. Weaner heifers returned $3.96 to $4.00 for heavyweights, and $4.20 to $4.26 for the lighter weights. Yearling steers made from $4.06 up to $4.68, and yearling heifers returned $3.56 to $4.12, quality dependent. Grown steers weighing over 500 kilos made $3.82 to $4.12, and the lighter weights from $3.96 to $4.18 a kilo. Grown heifers weighing under 540 kilos made from $3.40 to $4.00, and heavier weights returned $3.60 to $3.86 a kilo. Heavyweight cows made from $3.06 to $3.38, and store cows were down 5 cents, selling at $2.40 to $2.94 a kilo. The heavy bulls eased, returning $2.60 to $2.92, while medium and lightweight bulls returned $2.50 to $4.00, quality dependent. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for the world today. Arrests made after multiple Hong Kong tower blazes. Hundreds remain missing, feared dead. Two National Guardsmen are in a critical condition after a targeted shooting in Washington, D.C. The government's environment law reforms to pass after a deal done with the Greens. And 10 years after his sister won it, Australia's Robert Irwin takes out the U.S. reality ratings juggernaut, Dancing with the Stars. Those stories and more. Join me for the world today.
It is 2 minutes away from one. And on the text line, Jason has sent in just about that story we ran a little bit earlier on postnatal rage. And he says, what a brave lady. For Ali Gossage to speak out like she has takes a whole lot of courage and empathy for others in the same position as her. I wish her all the very best and congratulate her on her journey to recovery. She should stand tall and be proud of herself for recognising she needed help and seeking it out. But not everyone liked that segment, did they, Richard?
No, we had a little bit of post-segment rage. Steve's texted in with, you're joking, putting this item on a farming production program. Well, Steve, I actually also applaud Ali Gossage. The Country Hour once upon a time was only for male farmers. It's no longer the case. We have grown up just a little bit in the last 80 years. It's not just for the men, and it's not just for farmers. It's for everyone who's involved in or interested in primary industries. And I was very intrigued to hear one thing that Ali said helped her was having an understanding and supportive partner. It's always very, very important. Just very quickly, Lorna Byrne, who was the first rural broadcaster for the ABC that you just heard, she talked about the hair of the dog. Do you know where that comes from?
I'm about to.
Well, you might know it as being when you have a drink after you've had a big night out, but it's a shortened version of hair of the dog that bit you. Early English medical theory suggested rubbing the hair of a particular dog into the wound of its bite would cure the ill effects and heal the wound. Who'd have thought?
Well, I know what it's like to have a sore head out after a big night out. Thank you, Richard. Okay, well, I will talk to you tomorrow. It's coming up to news time. It is 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.